which maybe your audience will remember when Syria fragmented into various militias. And there was just as much infighting among those militias, among themselves, between the opposition groups, just as much as they were fighting the Syrian government. So basically, their groups similar to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham were fighting each other. And then there was a period of reconsolidation, particularly in the aftermath of the attack on ISIS and the kind of permanent or the, you know, more or less consolidation of Syria into various spheres of influence with U.S. presence and Kurdish-led political and military groups in the northeast, Turkish control in the northwest. And under the areas that were generally under Turkish influence, there were areas that were directly tied to Turkey and areas in which Turkey had influence. And this is the area that came to be consolidated by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. So they have a bloody history, not just prior to the war, but actually during the war, with respect to even other opposition groups and kind of basically, you know, during the time of their rule in the province of Idlib. Right now, and during this past 2 weeks, there's been a lot of positive signs in terms of the way they approached the collapse of the Syrian regime. The signs that were verbal, the signs that were actually in actions in terms of trying to protect all government institutions, all public institutions, despite the fact that there have been incidents of looting and sabotage in various ways, but at least they've been trying to speak at a national, of a national interest in some ways. That's, of course, has to be put to the test. There's already critiques of their rule because they unilaterally imposed a transitional government on Syria, which most Syrians would reject as something that they don't have the authority to do. It's also happening at in a context where, of course, Syria is still under economic sanctions. So you've had devastation from many years of the war, and you've had also devastation of Syrian society because of the crippling economic sanctions, primarily imposed by the U.S. and the European Union.
We just have 30 seconds.
So all of that is really going to be basically coming into play over the coming days, basically, and months. And we'll see how, you know, the regional context basically influences what's happening domestically.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Of course, we're going to continue to follow what happens with Syria. Omar Dahi, Syrian-American economics professor at Hampshire College and director of the Security and Context Research Network. Coming up, we go to the West Bank to a new report by B'Tselem. As thousands of Syrians are being released from Syrian prisons, we'll look at a new report on Palestinian prisoners in Hebron in the occupied West Bank. It's called Unleashed, Abuse of Palestinians by Israeli Soldiers in the Center of Hebron. Back in 20 seconds.
ولا ولد السلطان حاجيتك ما جيتك ودينا بعيد مدى الدنيا حاجيتك.
Rawi, the storyteller by Sawad Massi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As Israeli raids continue across the occupied West Bank, we turn to a new report from the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem that details the gruesome abuse of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in Hebron. B'Tselem documented the testimonies of over 20 Palestinians between May and August. They describe being punched, kicked, sexually abused, beaten with rifles, clubs, or chairs, being whipped with a belt, having foul-smelling liquid poured on them. In one case, even being stabbed by Israeli soldiers. One of the Palestinian teens, B'Tselem, Salem spoke to is Mahmoud Ghanem, an 18-year-old engineering student attacked by five Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint in July. A warning to our audience, these testimonies are graphic.
They dragged us to the Jeep and made us kneel. I was still tied up. Then he blindfolded me, grabbed me by the hair, and banged my head against the Jeep door three times, each harder than before. He hit me violently on my chest and stepped hard on my legs. Then he started punching me in the stomach. One of them grabbed me by the neck and pulled me up until I couldn't breathe. The other punched me hard in the stomach. Then, while I was trying to catch my breath, he stepped on my testicles.
And this is the testimony of 52-year-old Yasser Abu Makieh, who lives across from the Gilbert checkpoint in Hebron and is the director of the Ibrahim al-Khalil Association in Tel Rameda, which is involved in cultural and educational projects in the occupied West Bank. He was questioned, detained, and beaten by Israeli soldiers in July.
They treated me barbarically and arrested me for no reason. I was in pain and suffered beating, humiliation, and mental torture. I was very confused and scared. When I got to the Gilbert checkpoint by my house, an Israeli soldier demanded my ID card, and I handed it over. He demanded the phone, too, and I handed it over. Then he said, "You're making a lot of trouble. You gave an interview on Al Jazeera." And I said, "That's right, I did." He tied my hands and ordered me to sit on the ground. The four soldiers from the military post arrived. They blindfolded me, and before they took me away, they hit me on the head and kicked me.
Those are some of the disturbing testimonies included in B'Tselem's new report titled Unleashed, Abuse by Palestinians by Israeli Soldiers in the Center of Hebron. Since launching its war on Gaza last October, Israel's intensified attacks across the occupied West Bank, carrying out near daily raids that have led to the arrest of some 12,000 Palestinians. For more, we go to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Sarit Michaeli, the International Outreach Director for the Israeli Human Rights Group B'Tselem. Sarit, welcome back to Democracy Now! We are seeing images of thousands fleeing Syrian prisons and hearing the stories of hell inside. You, at the same time, have come out with this report on what's happening to Palestinian prisoners in Hebron. Describe what shocked you most in what you are learning.
I mean, thank you very much, Amy and Juan. It's good to be with you. And I think the most fundamental issue is that Israel claims to be a different society to Syria, right? Israel claims to be a democracy. We would argue that this is not the case. But in terms of the standards we have to set, these are just absolutely different standards to what we would expect. In terms of what we discovered in this report, I think on some levels, in a sense, the obvious. We've seen the increase, the massive increase in the violence that Israel has inflicted on Palestinians since Hamas's criminal actions, criminal attack on October 7th, in the, you know, the slaughter in Gaza, and also in the dehumanization discourse inside Israel. And therefore, on many levels, it's not surprising that Israeli soldiers who listen to Israeli leaders will act in a way that reflects this dehumanization. But there is also something extremely shocking about this, because the violence that we documented, it was new, not because there hasn't been violence by soldiers against Palestinians in the West Bank and in the city of Hebron before, but the scope of it, the scale of it, the fact that it was done in broad daylight, the fact that it was almost random in terms of the choice of victim. It wasn't people being beaten up for something they allegedly did, like throwing stones or being rude. It was Palestinians being beaten up and facing severe abuse merely for being Palestinians. In some way, it's as if the soldiers were just revenging Hamas's attack kind of imposing this vengeance on all Palestinians. They were selected almost at random, and this was done broadly. It's very clear that everyone was aware that this was being done.
And Sarit, very few, according to your report, of the people who were initially detained or even charged with any offense?
I think this is exactly the point. It's not as if Palestinians arrested someone, had an actual realistic allegation against them, whether that's true or not, and then proceeded to beat them up. Soldiers approached Palestinians who were going about their daily business. In some cases, they looked for some sort of so-called, quote-unquote, excuse to beat them up, right? So if they had some sort of photo in their phone that the soldiers could interpret as being problematic from their perspective, or in other cases, just the mere fact of walking down the street while Palestinian was enough to trigger this abuse. That's why we talk about it as being quite arbitrary. The victims were selected just by, for just going about their daily business. Additionally, I think one of the other really relatively new things, or the new developments about what we see on the ground, is that there were many threats of sexual violence. This is something I think we should be aware of, we should be mindful of over the past year. Types of sexual violence and threats in our context. Additionally, I think several of the witnesses reported that the soldiers were documenting these incidents, presumably to broadcast them then on social media, and in one case to send to a fiancé, to friends. So none of this is being done in a secretive way. It's all being done in broad daylight.
And also, is Hebron unique in this situation, or is it emblematic of what is going on across the West Bank?
So Hebron is unique in the sense that it is the only Palestinian town or city in the West Bank where there is a constant military presence right in the city center because of the Israeli settlements that are based in the center of Hebron. So because of that, there is always a constant contact, there's an interface between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians in their daily lives. So in that sense, Hebron is unique. But we surmise, we think, and we've reached the conclusion that this level of violence would reflect not just the conduct of soldiers, of Israeli soldiers and other members of the Israeli forces in Hebron city center, but that they are a much broader phenomenon. And we, as an Israeli organization that includes both Israelis and Palestinians, we look also at Israeli society and at what this indicates about the current moment in our society. And I think this is a really important point. The fact that these soldiers know what the spirit of the commander is. They're not doing something of their own private initiative. They're performing abuse that has been called for, has been incited for by Israeli leaders, by politicians, by Israeli media extensively over the past year.
Finally, Sarit Michaeli, so you have close to 800 Palestinians dead on the West Bank since October 7th, killed by Israeli soldiers. You have settlers. You have 12,000 imprisoned. What are you calling for? What is B'Tselem calling for?
Well, we have discussed in detail what we call the silent war that Israel is conducting in the West Bank. On some levels, it's not totally silent, but this is what one of our witnesses really referred to it. I think one of the main issues that B'Tselem has been addressing over this past year is the connection between our war against the entire Palestinian people, primarily my government essentially has been doing in Gaza, the mass killing of civilians, the utter destruction of Gaza, the devastating humanitarian disaster that our government has caused, together, and the connection between this and violence and abuse by soldiers and the use of lethal force, extreme and disproportionate use of lethal force in the West Bank. These are all connected issues, and they can only be addressed with some level of accountability, not just for the crimes being perpetrated in the Gaza Strip, but also for these crimes, for these abuses. We know accountability isn't going to come from within. The Israeli system is unwilling and unable to hold Israeli soldiers and Israeli forces accountable. On the contrary, what they are doing is the result of official incitement, and therefore there has to be international accountability for this. And as we have always stated, the international community has to also act to hold Israeli policymakers accountable for these violations.
Sarit Mikhaeli, we want to thank you for being with us with the Israeli Human Rights Group at B'Tselem. The new report will link to Unleashed, Abuse by Palestinians of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in the center of Hebron. Next up, Luigi Mangione has been arrested and charged with the murder of UnitedHealth executive Brian Thompson. As many offered condolences to Thompson's loved ones, we'll look at how his killing has sparked outrage over the state of health care in the United States. Back in 20 seconds.
Open up your eyes, it's a brand new nation. The people got a prize and a blood celebration. You always used to say that life is not a paid vacation, and living is a curse if you ain't got the purse to pay them. And we can all be free so long as we ain't all too patient. Be a thorn upon the roads, deny, defend, oppose. Yeah, he turned like a worm, but he looked to the graveyard. But guns got a way of hitting hearts, no matter how hard.
Wish you deny, defend, oppose, a song by the folk musician Joe DeVito. The song he shared a few days ago in response to the news of the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO. DeVito said, I wanted to throw my two cents in and try and convey that rage and why people are so angry. While people express horror over the murder of the executive, people are also expressing outrage. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. New York prosecutors have charged a suspect with murder for the killing of UnitedHealth executive Brian Thompson. Police arrested 26-year-old Luigi Mangione in Altoona, Pennsylvania, Monday, when a McDonald's customer told an employee that she spotted him after that five-day nationwide search. The employee called the police, who came. They found Mangione with a black ghost gun, which can be assembled from parts and is untraceable. That's similar to one used in the killing of Thompson. While many offered condolences to Thompson's loved ones, his killing sparked outrage over the state of health care in America. Some turned to social media to share their experiences with health insurance companies.
United Healthcare denials of coverage. Interesting that one of the shell casings had the word deny written on it. And it made me think of the time they tried to deny coverage for my mother's dialysis. Yes, you heard that correctly. United Healthcare tried to deny coverage for dialysis.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Derek Rowe is with the nonprofit People's Action Institute, which has a care over cost campaign focused on the health insurance company's, quote, systemic practice of refusing to approve care through prior authorization denials or pay for care through claim denials. And in Philadelphia, we're joined by Wendell Potter, former executive for the health insurance companies Cigna and Humana. He's the executive editor of Healthcare Uncovered. Wendell is the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider, speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans, and also the book Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Wendell, let's begin with you. When you heard that the CEO of UnitedHealth was murdered on the streets of New York, that the assassin had written the words deny, depose, defend on the bullets, there was this outpouring of anger about healthcare companies, while at the same time, many, of course, expressed condolences to the family of Brian Thompson. Your thoughts?
It was chilling, but not shocking to me. I used to plan the kind of events that Brian Thompson was in New York for, the company's investor day. And I want to stress that because it's significant that that's why he was in New York, to attend probably the most important meeting in the company's year, which is meeting with its top institutional investors and Wall Street financial analysts who write reports that help determine the fate of these companies on Wall Street. That's what these companies That's where they worship. They worship at the altar of Wall Street. I think what we're seeing here is this young man, if this is the suspect who's been arrested, is the assailant, experienced some kind of delay, apparently, or some kind of interaction that did not go well with his insurance company and with the industry. This has been going on for a long time. This company in particular has a record of using prior authorization or refusing to pay for needed care far more than its competitors. But for-profit insurers in general have used this as a means of enriching their shareholders, of using fewer and fewer of our premium dollars to pay for the care that we need so that more money can be made available to their shareholders.
Now, I wanted to ask Wendell Potter, there are about an average of 75 homicides per day in the United States. And I was stunned by the level of media attention and law enforcement resources utilized to track down this one killer of a wealthy businessman and health executive. I'm wondering your sense of where our system places its resources.
You know, it's a very good point. So many resources were put on this, obviously, for one reason, because it became such a big media story, and the drama around this made it certainly a compelling story. But we're talking about a person of privilege and great wealth who was killed, and that triggered this this manhunt that I think as you said, there are homicides every day in this country, sadly, but you don't have this kind of reaction. But I think part of what's going on here, back to the rage that we've seen on social media, it's just been just barely below the surface, and this triggered something. I'm equating this to kind of a dike bursting. I saw this rage, this outrage, if you will, toward this industry when I worked for it, and it was one of the reasons why I left. I couldn't, in good conscience, continue to support an industry that used prior authorization, that established themselves firmly between a patient and his or her doctor. That's what these companies have done. And I think that what we're seeing, sadly, in some form or fashion, probably was inevitable, because more and more people are facing these denials of care or denials of claims. So people are winding up deep in debt. 100 million Americans have medical debt, but most of those people have health insurance, but they can't get their insurance companies to cover the care that they need. They have to spend so much money out of their own pockets before their coverage will even kick in. So it is a crisis that was brewing, and I think has erupted. And I think the challenge is going to be, what do we make of this? How do we harness this rage? When I say we, I'm talking about advocates and those who know that this system needs a fundamental overhaul like we've never seen before. How do we harness this and channel it in constructive ways to push reforms forward?
I wanted to go back to the healthcare point, but I also wanted to amplify the issue that Juan just raised. New York City Mayor Eric Adams was speaking during the news conference Monday about the arrest of Mangione when he was asked about another case here in New York.
I wanted to ask you about the killing of a migrant teenager last week in the financial district. A group of men attacked him and another migrant after reportedly asking him whether he spoke English or not. What updates do you have in that case? And do you have images of the suspects in that case? And if so, why haven't those been publicized, as we saw in this other case? And has the same amount of police resources been spent on his death as the CEO's death?
First and foremost, the fact pattern that you just described about asking, did he speak English, that was not in any of the reports. Any loss is a huge loss.
Right. That is Mayor Adams, and they were talking about the killing of the migrant just a day after Yeremy Colina, who is 17 years old. A group came upon him, and a friend said, "Do you speak English?" When they said no, he was killed. The other was critically wounded. And this question of whether they handed it, got video and photos of the gang that moved on. But we're going to stick right now on the health care issue. Derek Crowe is with us of People's Action Institute. Derek, you've been collecting testimony. Your group was involved with a mass arrest. I want to turn to the Color Lines video report that features 29-year-old Carly Morton of Beaver, Pennsylvania, who was supported by People's Action's Care Over Cost campaign.
I have been fighting my medical issues in my insurance company off and on for more than a year. I cried and screamed and requested supervisors. They made it impossible. I thought that that was the end of the road. I'm not getting the surgery, so there's not much of a chance for me. We reached out to People's Action, and they gathered together around me and helped me fight my insurance company. And then when that change happened, it was like all this hope just went inside of me.
Derek Crowe of People's Action Institute, you've been putting out videos like these. A whole group of people affiliated with People's Action Institute were just recently arrested outside the offices of the Minneapolis headquarters of United Health. Explain.
Right. Well, first, let me say that we also offer our condolences to the family and friends of Brian Thompson. We obviously condemn any act of gun violence, no matter the motivation. We were shocked by that crime. We were not shocked by the outpouring of rage you mentioned. And I just want to say the thing that took us to that location and that led us to that action were stories just like Carly's. These corporations have too much power in this country. They are blocking progress on issues like gun violence and on the epidemic of care denials in this country, either through prior authorizations or through claims denials. Just like Carly, 248 million care denials are issued by these companies every year, either through a prior authorization denial or a care denial. And people's anxiety and stress and anger about that has just built up to a boiling point. Carly's case, she finally got paid her claim for that surgery only because she worked with us and gathered around with other people who organized in a strategic, nonviolent way to put pressure on these companies. Her condition is terribly painful. It's called NMALS. It's pain when she eats is equivalent, her doctors say, to end-stage pancreatic cancer. And this corporation was refusing to give her the care that she needed, that she had been paying premiums for. And we had to literally take her pain to their front door to get their attention. Now, we were happy to do that. We want to do that for everybody that joins us at careovercost.org. But we can't do that 248 million times a year. Something's got to change.
Derek Crowe, we only have about 30 seconds, but I wanted to ask you quickly, Medicare Advantage, which Brian Thompson ran for United Healthcare, the privatization of Social Security, we're seeing all these ads about open enrollment the past few weeks. What are you urging in terms of the government's use of this privatization of Medicare?
Well, we must stop the government from turning over Medicare to companies like United Healthcare through privatization schemes like Medicare Advantage. And we've also got to get policymakers to take the claims review process, the appeals process, out of the hands of corporations like this and get our healthcare focused on people's needs and not corporate profit.
Well, we'll leave it there for now, but of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. We're going to do a part two with the two of you. We hope you can both stay to talk about where you're directing your efforts now as we move into the Trump administration part two. Derek Crowe with People's Action Institute speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and Wendell Potter, former executive for the health insurance companies Cigna and Humana. He's executive editor of Healthcare Uncovered and author of the books Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans, and also the book Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. Tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.